Welcome to Popcorn Psychology, the podcast where we watch blockbuster movies and psychoanalyze them. My name is Brittany Brownfield, and I'm a child therapist, and I'm joined by...
Ben Stover, individual therapist.
Hannah Espinoza-Rimas, marriage and family therapist.
We are all licensed clinical professional counselors, also known as therapists, who practice out of the Ardent Counseling Center in Chicago, Illinois. Even though we are licensed mental health professionals, this podcast is purely for entertainment purposes and to fulfill our love of dissecting pop culture in all forms. And today, we're finally talking about Harry Potter, more specifically, the first four movies. We're going to do the whole of Harry Potter movie franchise in three different episodes over the next few months. We're going to break them up, but for the first one we're going to do movies 1 through 4, so that is starting with Sorcerer's Stone, ending with Goblet of Fire, just because those first, especially the first two movies, are really just introducing us to the world of Harry Potter and all the characters, and it's not so much, I guess, messy psychological meat as, like, especially the back four. The last four.
Right, those get so much heavier and so much more adult.
So we're going to do 5 and 6 together and 7 and 8 together. Yep. I mean, especially since 7 and 8 are the same book, essentially. So we're going to do our best to just talk about the first four movies, which will be hard, I think, just because Harry Potter is so pervasive in culture that I think it's hard to not think of it as a whole story.
Yeah.
So we're going to do our best to just keep it to the... to not talk too much outside of the first four movies. And we're also, instead of doing themes as how we dividing it up the podcast, we're going to do it by movies today. So we're going to talk about each movie individually and kind of what we see in each one, and then talk about treatment. And so it might seem a little less, I don't want to say organized, because I think it's going to feel maybe not as like centered into a theme base, like anchored in themes. So it might be more all over the place and more information than we usually do, because it isn't centered in themes. But
right, yeah. Right, because each movie introduces new characters and new plot lines, but yet it's still part of an overarching plot line. So
yeah,
there's reasons for doing this. Also, when doing research, we kind of figured out that, you know, J.K. Rowling, when she did this, she had already planned out 1 through 3 as a set arc before she even finished writing the first one. So we kind of found out that, you know, like the last 7 movies in this, they happen at a little different pace, and there's some things that change, whereas 1 through 3 were like a set arc.
Because I would argue that the very end of book, a movie 4, it's going to be really hard for me to say movie and book, like, I'll probably interchange those a lot.
You could just say year 4.
Year 4 is, spoiler, it's also going to be full spoilers, and so get over that, people.
Well, I mean, Harry Potter's been out for, you know.
I know. Almost 20 years, because in my opinion, year 4 with the death of Cedric, that kind of kicks off everything in terms of, I think, where all the heavy duty psychological stuff really comes into play. And so that's kind of where this episode will end, is with that death. And then so the next ones, I think, will be meatier, but this one is a good introduction to a lot of themes. Absolutely. That we will definitely continue to affect Harry's life and everyone else's life.
Yeah, I think
in the last four.
Building the relationships and introducing characters and what the world is like, and just a lot of that, setting all of those things up, which I think is also part of what makes the movie so magical.
Well, yeah, and I think so. And I think it doesn't, like, it turns from being so magical, like, right at the end at 4. Like, when Cedric's father comes out and, like,
oof,
you see, like...
I cried. Like, I cry every time.
Harry down, and, like, everyone's, like, the band is playing and things are going. That is signifying the end of the magicalness right there. Because, I mean, then you meet Bellatrix and Fenrir, and you meet, like, the people who are, like, truly evil. Whereas in this movie, like... or the rest of the movies, like, the big bad is still kind of not really there yet. So you deal with, like, small bads throughout the rest of the movies.
I mean, because what she does so well, and which I really appreciated as a child therapist, is that she really, and by she, I mean J.K. Rowling, she really writes these characters to be the age that they are. And so the first four movies, because they're just younger, it's a lot more simplistic issues, you know, a lot more, like, child issues. That doesn't mean that they're not serious and that they don't have weight, because, you know, everything's important when it's happening to you. You know, everything's relative. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't have the gravitas that, like, the older the later movies have, because they're older and so things are more complicated and more things have happened that make things complicated.
And also their development is different, so they're also able to understand more as they get older as well. And so I think that's also a part of it, is that meeting them and in year one, they're so different because they're just little and they just don't have the development to have kind of those deep issues that come up in the other ones.
So the first movie, The Sorcerer's Stone, kind of opens with you getting a feel for Harry Potter's home life with the Dursleys, which is probably the most, to me, the most significant thing in the first movie in terms of psychology, which is his life with the Dursleys. I mean, they are neglectful, in my opinion, and they're very emotionally abusive. They don't seem, they're the kind of physically abusive that's usually pretty tolerated. Like, people will probably say that they're just firm with him. You know, they are rough with him, but, like, not necessarily physically abusive. That would be, like, someone's opinion more than it would be, like, a fact. Like, we're mandated reporters, and it would be a scenario where I probably, if I knew I had a client who was getting, like, living underneath the stairs and being made to do everything in the home like a servant, I probably would make a report to Child Services just to be on the safe side.
Oh, absolutely.
But I would doubt that they would investigate it because he still has technically a private room, even though it probably doesn't meet the requirements of a room.
Yeah.
And he is clothed, he's fed, he doesn't have any, as we can see, any physical, like, marks on him, like bruises or anything.
Right.
Like, he's technically taken care of. Even, they even talk about how they're sending him away to school, even though it's, like, I don't know if away to school, but they're sending him to school, you know, they're dyeing his uniform in, like, the pot on the stove. That might be the second movie, but, like, they're technically taking care of him in a way that's recognized by the state, I guess.
Yeah.
Even though it is horrible how they treat him.
Yeah, he's, I mean, he's absolutely showing signs of someone who's being emotionally abused. And he doesn't take care of himself. He's dirty. He's a little timid and afraid of, like, the people he lives with. And then
he doesn't stand up for himself, but in a way that as a child you wouldn't, maybe, anyway. But especially when you don't trust that, like, if you stand up for yourself, you're not going to get retaliated upon,
or don't feel like you have worth.
True.
And that you are allowed to stand up for yourself.
He definitely takes a lot of what they ask of him in stride, or how they treat him in stride. Like, when they're like, start cooking this food, he just starts cooking the food. Like, he there is no, like, throwing fits or refusing. He is pretty compliant.
It would be interesting to see what it was like when he was a baby, kind of, and how he was treated, and, like, was he left to cry, like, just on end, like, what was that like, and who and what did they do before he could help?
Right, because we're looking at, I mean, Harry's 10, he's about to be 11 when we first meet him.
Yeah.
And he gets into the care of the Dursleys when he's 1.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I guess all the hatred coming off of them is purely based on, I assume, the fear of the other, because his aunt at least knows that his parents are magical, and therefore he's probably magical, and so it does seem to be, like, they just detest him for being different, I assume, in, like, a way, because he doesn't seem, he's a pretty nice kid, he doesn't do anything, really, like, he doesn't, you know, he's not offensive in any way.
The way that the mother, that the aunt says that his mother was a freak, the hate that is in her voice and the fear that is in her voice when she says that for the first time in the movie, I feel like really shows how disgusted they are with what Harry is and what with what be, and what he could be, and really disgusted that they're, that that exists and that they have to have a part in it.
The disgust is huge.
Like, they would, she would rather just live their life with their one son and, like, not have to ever consider that there's a magical world out there.
And I wonder if they would be so, they, the way they idolize Dudley, I wonder if they would idolize him so much if he didn't have the counterpart of Harry. You know what I mean? Because they really have split the way they treat those boys. And I wonder if he'd be so, like, on this pedestal and spoiled if it wasn't as a reaction to Harry. You know what I mean? I wonder if that, like, got pumped up over the years and then he got more and more spoiled because...
Yeah, because how... Aren't they similar in age?
They're the same age, I think. They're going, so to, they're going the same, both going to school.
Right. So if they're the same age, then they were both babies at the same time, which means there was a period of time where they had, where she probably, right? I don't know if the dad does a lot, that she was taking care of both of the babies at the same time, because they were both would have been really little, and how and what did that look like?
Yeah. I mean, it also could just be their attitude towards Harry could just be like, that's shitty, but just feeling put upon that they had to take care of this kid.
Yeah.
And not really growing up out of that and just continuing to feel resentful, even though they don't seem like they're struggling for resources at all. I mean, they spoil the fuck out of Dudley.
Oh, that's
and that money could be going towards Harry as well. And it didn't seem like they would be struggling if they split the resources between the two boys.
Absolutely.
Because it's not like they were, like, barely feeding Dudley, and then they also had to feed Harry.
Clearly not.
Yeah.
They were, you know, they seemed fine. They were well-dressed. They had good food. Like, they were entertaining in their house, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And giving him, like, what, 37 presents or some shit?
Yeah, a whole lot. And, like, he was so spoiled.
Yeah.
So spoiled.
And...
Only 37?
I mean, I literally...
38 last year.
I literally wrote, Dudley, sociopath, ? In my notes.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I don't like to say that about a child because they are children. And so they're also just reacting with, like, their instincts. And, like, you know, they're not, like, that manipulative yet at that age.
Well, and also just reacting to the environment that they're set up in. I mean, Dudley is set up in an environment where he is the star. He is the golden child. He is the best. And Harry is the worst. Harry is the black sheep. And Harry is the one that all of the problems rest on and all the reasons why everything bad happens. And Dudley is only seen as this kind of golden light. I mean, I can't imagine a kid not having an ego struggle being in that environment.
And also being modeled that the way you treat people is conditional, the respect you have for people is conditional. Like, you can just treat people like shit just because you feel like it. Because he hasn't seen a reason why his parents would treat Harry the way that they do.
No. No, he doesn't know any different. And he just... And then it shows that it's okay to bully.
Oh, for sure.
Because I might be wrong, but I think they send Dudley and Harry to different schools, too.
Oh, well, they're sending Dudley's to some fancy ass school where he's wearing that stupid hat and that, like, little uniform.
Right.
And then they were sending Harry off to, I guess, whatever the local public is my assumption.
Yeah, that's what it seemed like.
Right, so they're already creating, like, a class establishment between Harry and Dudley, where they're showing that, you know, like, you're better than Harry and it's okay to treat people that you're better than, like, dirt.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're pretty one-dimensional people.
Yeah.
They're very much written and portrayed in the movie as just, like, these people are villains. They're very clearly villains. Like, they don't really have a lot of depth. I guess the only kind of depth you could give them is that they might be acting out of fear, you know, about Harry.
Yeah.
But still, to treat a child that way. But I've also worked with families where, because of the fear or trauma or abuse that the parents have gone through, they've projected that onto the kids in their life and kind of treated these kids, projected a lot of deep feelings onto the children and treated the children with those deep feelings that the kids did not deserve.
Yeah. Or earn. Well, it makes me wonder how it was in Petunia's family with Lily.
Like, I wonder if Lily was
considered the special golden child, and Petunia was considered kind of not special and just do whatever, we don't care, we're playing with Lily today. Like, if that's why, because Harry unfortunately gets that in a couple of different ways, right? So if he could possibly get it from the Dursleys because of the mother's experience, and then he also gets it from Snape because of Snape's relationship with his dad.
Yeah. I mean, I think what's a shame in this movie, like you're saying, is that there's an example of a lot of grown-ups taking out their own histories with people onto these children that have not earned it.
Yeah.
But I mean, but that's not atypical. Like, I mean, where I grew up in the Midwest, like, I would hear adults talk shit about kids because their mom was a single mom who had them in high school. You know what I mean? Like, that kid's a bad kid because her mom had her in high school. You know what I mean? So that's also not an atypical thing to do, unfortunately, is to glom traits onto a child or guilt or shame or reputation onto a child because of what you perceive about their parents or what their parents have done to you. I mean, it's all just wildly immature.
Yeah, absolutely.
And just not dealing with your own issues and projecting them all out.
So how hard and kind of interesting it would be for Harry to go from being in this setting where he's despised and neglected and is either ashamed of him and he can't do anything right to being a celebrity.
Yeah, it's a huge shift. Like,
in this other world where he is the most, in most some people's eyes, the chosen one, the a very powerful wizard, and like all of these things that he has no idea about. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, like, the first thing he's, I mean, I wrote down the first thing he says when I think he gets told that he's a wizard is, I'm Harry, I'm just Harry.
Yeah.
Because his narrative, as we like to say, his identity is just being, like, a nothing.
Right. He's totally believes himself a nothing, and he has trouble accepting or even processing that he is something special, that he is... Mm-hmm. has an identity that has value, let alone being like a celebrity and a hero to an entire world of people he didn't know existed.
And also, I mean, I think too, like, as far as I, was there any pictures of his parents that he saw before Hagrid gave him that picture?
I don't think so.
Because also part of it too, which is the identity issue and the depth of him being feeling like nothing, is he doesn't even have his parents' identities or images, or probably knows nothing about them besides negative stuff that Petunia might have said.
Right.
To identify himself with, to align himself with. Because a lot of us learn who we are by finding attributes in our parents that we see in ourselves. And that is, like, usually the first way we form our identity. And so he has nothing, well, besides negative stuff. But I feel like probably even then, they probably didn't talk about his parents that much, period. Besides a flippant remark here and there.
That's right, to call them freaks. Yeah. Right.
But
right.
He probably doesn't know what they look like. Because I think a big impact on him, which they say a lot in the movies, is how much he looks like both of his parents in different ways. And how that seems to really mean a lot to him.
Yeah.
Because they always say he looks exactly like his father, but has his mother's eyes. Is that kind of, that's what they always say about him, right?
Yeah, that's what they always say. Mm-hmm. And also just also wanting to have all of the information that he could possibly have. Mm-hmm. Like, he really, I think part of why it means so much to him is because he doesn't have anything to go on. He doesn't have anything that he can have hope about his parents. Like, mm-hmm. it might even be where he doesn't even think about them or fantasize about them. Like, maybe a child. Like an emptiness there. Right. It's just blank. It's just dark area is how I think of it.
Well, and then it also has translated over into his social development, because I don't think he has any friends.
Oh, no.
Not until, you know, he meets Ron and then later Hermione.
Yeah.
I mean, I get that he... I assume he had to have gone to school legally, but it doesn't seem like he went to school.
I know. I was just thinking that, too. It seems
like he was just, like, kept in the house until eventually he had to go to school. Like, it's just... I mean, I guess they do take him to the zoo, and he talks to that snake.
That's so awesome.
But, you know, he does seem like he doesn't have any friends to speak of. Like, he doesn't get out of... It doesn't seem like he gets out of the house and sees friends.
No, which, I mean, at that age, particularly, if you're not going out and hanging out with people and doing things and part of the social structure, even if of the street or whatever, like, I don't think he would be included in anything, because he'd always be like, no, I can't go, I can't go, and kids are going to stop asking. Mm-hmm. So I imagine he's pretty isolated until Hagrid shows up and all of a sudden, like, he's...
And brings him a birthday cake and tells him that he's a wizard.
That he's special.
He does magic in front of him. Like, he's never seen magic before. He does magic in front of him.
He's got a lot of money now.
Yeah, he finds out that he's rich.
I mean, it also makes sense why then he becomes such good friends with literally the first people he meets, which is Ron and Hermione.
Yeah, absolutely. The first people that show him some acceptance.
He imprints like a baby duck.
Oh, and Hagrid, too, because there's a relationship with Hagrid, even though we find out that Hagrid is sort of a marked person. He's been socially ostracized for what we find out about in movie two. But, like, him being so, like, put into his own class where only, like, Dumbledore and Harry seem to have a sense of value towards him, but Harry globs onto him immediately.
Mm-hmm. It definitely seems like everybody that means a lot to Harry... Throughout the whole books, he meets in, like, the first half hour of the movie.
Yeah.
Arguably.
Yeah.
I mean, Dumbledore, McGonagall. I mean, they're also just big parts of the movies anyway. Like, right. They would be important anyway. But he definitely, his truest touchstones, socially, attachment-wise, seem to be the people that he meets in the very beginning of being introduced into the magical world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And he gets very ride or die for them very immediately as well.
Oh, very quickly. Can I just say, like, Richard Harris was exactly who I pictured in my head when I was reading the books when I heard Dumbledore? Mm-hmm. Like, exactly.
I mean, agree to disagree. Here's my thing. I think I love Gambon's, the second Dumbledore, so much. And I like, we were talking about this when we were watching the movies, me and Hannah. Last night. And I think I love his whimsicalness. They do definitely have a very different vocal performance.
Oh, for sure.
But I feel like also I read the first book so long ago, I can't tell you what I thought Dumbledore is. Because now Dumbledore in my brain is Michael Gambon's Dumbledore.
And I had watched the movies before I ever read the books. So I already had an idea of like what he would be like. I think what I really like about the way that the second guy plays him is that he does a really good job of having him be accessible, but also an enigma at the same time. Like, you know that he has a lot of secrets, but you also know that he really cares about Harry. Like, he's vulnerable enough in that aspect, but he's also, like, there's so many secrets and so many reasons for Harry not to trust any adults.
Right.
Mm-hmm. In his life.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and so, I mean, book one, movie one, year one, right away, like, one of his teachers, you know, betrays him. You know, it's got the Voldemort Quirrell in the back of the head.
Yeah.
And so there's an immediate, like, oh, I can't trust another adult.
Well, and Snape, too. Like, everybody is so nice to Harry and welcoming to her. And some McGonagall, I feel like, treats him just like any other kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Snape is down on him immediately, like, busting on him and embarrassing him in class. And
I feel like straight up trash, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm sure that's going to ruffle a lot of feathers, but I will stand by that opinion. And then I think kind of tying back to what we talked about with identity and not really knowing his parents at all. Yeah. I think that's why in this movie they have the Mirror of Izzared, I think is how they say it. Desire spelled backwards.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets so obsessive about that to the point that I think that's why Dumbledore moves it. Well, he moves it because I think it was part of like the Quirrell plot.
Yeah.
But I also think part of it is like, Harry keeps going back to it because I think it's the first time he really gets to like not just see his parents but see him now with his parents and kind of see how they are as a family unit.
Exactly.
And I can't imagine how
seeing himself
comforting that would feel.
Yeah, seeing himself as a son of Lily and James Potter.
He probably just sits in front of it and just like fantasizes about his parents and their life together.
Right, and what his life would have been. And also, you imagine how this has to have created kind of like an imposter syndrome in Harry, because like he's lived his whole life assuming that he's trash, and then now everybody but Snape tells him that he's not, whereas Snape is like, your father was trash and you're trash like him.
I mean, Harry is wildly well adjusted for emotionally for his background, you know. You would think that there'd be a lot more lashing out or self-sabotaging or just, like, mood swings and stuff.
Yeah.
But he doesn't really have... But I think that's a good example, which I don't know if I've ever talked about in here, of, like, some kids are just naturally more resilient. I mean, it has nothing to do with being a stronger person or a weaker person.
No.
Some kids just can get through stuff and be, quote-unquote, okay. Or, you know, or high-functioning is what I would... I guess I would call Harry very high-functioning.
Yeah.
For the life he's had so far, in that he can go to school, he can make friends, he's pretty emotionally stable. You know, he's not.
I mean, he
out
definitely.
In class. I
yeah,
mean, he takes a lot of wild chances.
Yes,
but he's not like screaming at people and getting in fights, and like even Draco, who is a big bully, who would like it doesn't escalate like it could.
Absolutely, and also just thinking about how if a child was in this situation in public school, there's a chance that he would have gotten taken away from them or something. Like, if he really was acting out in all the ways that he could be, and the fact that he's not doing that.
Yeah.
Is such a... And really just, I think you're absolutely right. I think it just shows that he's resilient.
Yeah, and when then we see Harry, too, like, dealing with the bullies and just kind of ignoring them. Like, Draco comes after him, and Draco and his little buddies, and then Snape is bullying him from the teacher's side. But we see Harry start to, like, have found a new identity where, like, I'm not trash. Like, I'm actually kind of special, and I don't have to be that. And then we see Harry, when he gets introduced to Quidditch, that he's, like, found this identity. Like, hold on, like, here's something I'm good at. He's probably never had that in his life.
Yeah. Yeah, and I wonder, too, because I do, this is something I noticed in the progression of these four movies, is he's more and more reactive to being bullied. But I wonder if that's partially because he's becoming more and more self-assured and more being able to accept that he doesn't deserve that kind of treatment. And maybe that's why he lashes out more and more. I mean, I think also part of it is just increased anger and testosterone, which we can get to when we talk about the older movies. But I mean, that could be part of it as well, is he's getting a better sense of self and a better sense of, I don't have to put up with this any longer. Because, I mean, probably the biggest long-term impact of the Dursleys with him is that he takes a lot of shit lying down. Like, he is very, like, sure, even does. With Draco and stuff, like, he does do a decent job of ignoring it, but not necessarily ignoring it because he's healthy, ignoring it because he's used to it.
Yeah.
And he's used to getting shit on.
Yeah.
And so, what's the point of fighting back, you know? And so that could be why, when the movies progress, he does get more aggressive.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
reactive.
So let's look at Harry as he goes through this. So what are the key points we see in the movie, like, where we start to see, like, identity? So we see Harry get introduced to the world from Hagrid, and then it moves into Diagon Alley, where I think Ollivander's shop is the next, like, really key point, where he gets the wand, where we start to find out that only one other feather from a phoenix has been given to this wand.
I mean, I think that's a good example of... Does Ollivander say it was Voldemort? He does say it's Voldemort, right?
Yes.
I don't appreciate how much all of these grown-ass people in these movies can't stop themselves from saying all this stuff to this child that he doesn't need to hear. Why is everyone keeps talking about Voldemort and how, like, it's just like Voldemort. And this is a kid that probably already has, like, some not great ideas about himself. So then you're going to continue to parallel him with arguably the most evil person that's ever lived.
Well, and then
he doesn't need to hear that, is what I'm saying.
No, he doesn't. And then, like, so we go through that, we kind of see that scene where he's, like, learning that he's as special as the most notorious but evil wizard ever. And then he finds out that he was part of Slytherin, and that any wizard who ever turns dark, so he gets this predisposition against Slytherin, which is, I think, putting kids into, like, different houses based on personality type is probably not a great move in general, because it's going to create, like, a clan-like community amongst them, like a tribal thing where they're going to compete against each other and try, and they make the kids compete against each other for the House Cup every year. Mm-hmm. But they create this, like, well, you're good enough to be part of this house, and then you see Harry without knowing anything about Slytherin or how Slytherin could help him.
I guess it's shitty that...
With the hat, right?
I guess it's shitty that there is of the four houses, there is a house that is just kind of known as where all the assholes go. Like,
yeah,
that's not
absolutely.
A great... I mean, they seem to, like, Draco seems to take great pride in being part of Slytherin, and I know that a lot of people, even in, like... are like the real world who take the test, like, there's some people who like being Slytherin and stuff, but, like, it is kind of crazy that just for the development of kids and their identity to have a house that is so, like, I think in, like, maybe, like, the second or third movie, McGonagall even, like, says, like, when she's giving the history of the second movie, when she's giving the history of the Chamber of Secrets, and she's like,
yes,
there are three ones that founded were, like, good people who loved everybody, and then that asshole Slytherin is a piece of shit. It's like, like if they were, like...
It's like word for word her speech
like,
right
just
there.
Because
pretty much, I mean.
It's crazy to think that they respected, if that founder was so evil, Hitler-esque, that they would still give him a house just because he helped found the place. You think that'd be one of those things that they were like, he used to have a house, but he was kind of trash, and so now there's just three houses.
Yeah.
Because I think it would fuck with kids' identities in terms of all the kids who go into Slytherin.
Well, the fact that Harry literally doesn't know anything about this world and already knows that he doesn't want to be Slytherin.
Right.
Like, that means that has a huge impact on kids who are getting sorted. I mean, even, like, I remember when I read the books about how scared he was about the sorting hat, because he didn't understand what it was. He knew that he would get put in a place where he might have to stay for a long time. He doesn't understand how anything works. He was really scared to be, like, he didn't know what it meant, but to already know that he didn't want to be Slytherin because of what they're telling him and what he's experiencing. Like,
yeah, that creates a lot of bias.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Which I think kind of, I mean, sliding into movie two, I mean, in movie two, it, like I just brought up, like it really talks about Slytherin as the other in that movie, because mm-hmm. they're also talking about the concept of, well, racism, which is mudbloods, which is the racist term for muggles or people who aren't 100% from pure. Wizard blood.
Right,
is it wizard
people
blood?
Aren't pure
magic
blood.
Born? Magic born?
I think they say pure blood.
Or pure born?
Pure blood.
No, mm-hmm. pure blood.
Pure blood and mud blood.
Yeah,
they go.
Born, is that what it
Podcast
is?
Podcast over.
Come on, Brittany, you're supposed to be the Ravenclaw of the group, okay?
Well, you know what? Slytherin over there, you can get off my butt about it.
Yes.
I guess we could also say I'm a Ravenclaw.
I'm a Slytherin, I just found out.
I am a Hufflepuff.
Exactly. And so in the second movie, there's a lot more of that divide of mm-hmm. us versus them. And I think that's Absolutely. Kind of like, I guess we would say the psychological morality tale in that movie is learning how to be accepting, you know, learning about racism, you know, because mm-hmm. they're 12.
12,
and so
yeah.
it's kind of also at the time in your life and your development where you can think abstractly and kind of understand concepts like social groups and the us and them mentalities and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And empathy.
Fun fact, reading Harry Potter actually makes kids more able to be sympathetic towards people of different backgrounds and to have mm-hmm. better tolerance for diversity and less tolerance for bullying based on that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Absolutely.
Because it's also the introduction of the Malfoy family, Draco's parents, and getting a real feel for those pieces of shit. Well, I think what I think is really interesting about the Malfoys and what I kind of wrote down in my notes is it's a clear example of how bullies don't come from a vacuum. Draco is the way Draco is because he comes from a toxic family.
Yes.
Like, I think a lot of times when we think about bullies or, like, the evil kids in movies, there's always this very one-dimensionalness about them. Like, that kid's just a dick.
Yeah.
And I think what the movie does really well and what it continues to do over the course of all the movies is give Draco a lot more depth in that in this movie, you're really getting the first glimpse of seeing why he is the way he is, which is he's from a family where you are encouraged to judge others, encouraged to bully others, you know, constantly having to assert your power by shitting on other people. And there's probably a lot of conditions around the love in that household.
Oh, I'm sure there are tons.
Yeah.
And also growing up, seeing that it's okay to abuse others who are different with the way they treat the house elf.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Dobby, yeah, correct.
Oh, Dobby.
Which, another fun nerd fact here is that there's actually a psychological effect named after Dobby the Elf, called the Dobby Effect, named for people who, and I'm sure we've seen people like this in our life, who struggle with making mistakes and overcorrecting themselves to the point that they may feel the need to punish themselves for making a mistake. And
it's like an extreme level of neuroticism.
Yeah, it is, but that now has a name that is
that
the Dobby Effect.
Very, a bunch of friggin' nerds thought that up and named it that.
I mean, I don't know how many research psychologists you've met, but most of them
They're
that
like,
I know.
I'm so excited to discover this thing and call it this.
They can they'd probably fit in your house.
But I do think what I like about the Malfoys as an idea is that, and why it gives me a lot of empathy for Draco,
yeah,
is that I'm sure there's a lot of very more subtle internalized abuse in that household.
Absolutely.
Where, oh, of course.
Where they, I wouldn't be surprised if Draco gets smacked around every once in a while.
Oh,
I wouldn't be surprised if he gets shit on a lot as much as he's probably also like touted, like praised. It's probably very like, we only love you if you do this or if you win this or, you know, and
or if you portray our family in a certain way. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, like,
don't
embarrass us. Like the intensity with which his father speaks in the movies and how angry he gets with Harry the one time.
And his disdain.
Yeah. I mean, he is fucking terrifying.
He is evil.
He is evil. Like, he's a straight up evil motherfucker. Like, this dude is bad. And he, like, knowing that, I can't imagine what it must be like for Draco in that household. Because if he is like that with Harry, who technically he's never fucking even met before, mm-hmm. what is he like with his own son?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's what, like, when dealing with characters like Draco and working with kids that are, like, angry like that and are mean to other kids like that, a way that I used to find empathy is I try to remind myself and remind other people, like, people who act like Draco are not happy people, and they don't come from happy homes. Like, happy right. people do not act that way.
No, and he has to validate himself by surrounding himself with people that are lesser than him, like Crab and Goyle.
Yeah. And he doesn't seem to mind. Like, he makes that comment, like, that he didn't know that one of them could read.
Yeah.
Because it's like, it is, he doesn't care if they're... he probably prefers that they're not his intellectual equals, because Draco doesn't seem stupid himself.
No, he's not. Not at all. Yeah. No.
And so that he chooses to kind of have two, like, subservient lackeys instead of, like, true friends.
Who just
kind of
follow him around like puppy dogs.
Which is probably what his dad's like. I bet his dad walks around alpha-dogging like an asshole and, like, doesn't have any equals in his mind that he, like, has around. Because it's all power stuff.
Other than
well.
Cornelius Fudge, the Minister of Magic. And any other Death Eaters. But yeah, no, he's like walks around like
it's all
he's
control.
King shit. Yeah.
You know, and so when you have to be in control all the time, you can never be in like satisfying relationships because that involves give and take and vulnerability and reciprocity that if you need to be in control all the time, you never will have.
Yeah.
So what about Gilderoy? I feel like he's somebody we have to talk about here from a psych standpoint. We have to talk about Gilderoy.
He's such a perfect cartoon version of someone with narcissistic personality disorder. So Gilderoy Lockhart, for those who might not remember, he is like the... He kind of looks like a Prince Charming-esque cartoon from a movie.
Yeah.
Like, he's very over the top. He writes a bunch of books. All the ladies swoon over him. He's very flouncy and like, ha-ha kind of energy all the time. And he becomes their defense against the dark arts. And he's so textbook narcissist personality disorder in such a funny, interesting way. Like, he is very deluded mm-hmm. about his sense of grandeur. By that I mean, like, he thinks he's so a bigger dude than he is,
and more powerful too. Like, and he like thinks that he's very good at all of these charms and look at all these things I can do. And then when he gets into the I think when he brings out the Boggart, right? No, Boggart's the third one. He brings out the fairies.
Oh, yeah. He releases that cage of fairies.
The fairies. He does the fairies. And then he can't handle them.
And he runs away.
And he runs away.
And leaves all these children in this room. Right. God bless Hermione.
Right. And then he gets into the duel with Snape and then makes it look like when he gets his ass whooped that, like... He was just demonstrating.
I mean, he continually puts the children in really unsafe positions.
Yeah.
Because he can't get out of his own asshole.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, that's part of why he's the more cartoony version, because he's also in this fantasy world.
Yeah.
But in more real life, what it is you kind of just keep making over-the-top statements about yourself and your abilities and your skills that aren't true. And also... straight up lie, which he does do, lie too about your achievements, lie about your worth in situations. Like, how would look porn like real life would be, I'm the top salesman at my job. Everyone knows that they can't make a sale unless I'm involved with it. And everyone just loves me and praises me for how good of a salesman I am. And maybe no one at the office gives a shit about him. Or maybe he has only made like maybe one or two sales.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's this very like built up idea in their brain about who they are because they need a constant validation from the outside world.
Absolutely. And he, when the pressure gets on him, he finally admits that his real skill is a memory charm with stealing other people's
mm-hmm.
Memories and then taking them for himself. So like, he's such like a demonstrates at the last second like this awareness of narcissism that you don't typically see, where they'd like manipulate others and admit doing it.
Yeah,
like a true mm-hmm. narcissist would probably never see their
They would never acknowledge, never have insight about it.
Yeah. That's the good word I'm looking for. There's the psych term of the day, insight.
Well, and I would also
today
say...
Today is brought to you by insight.
And I would say that he's a good example of narcissist in that he can't stop believing in what he's believing. Even when he's in peril, even when other people are in peril, like, it's... Because there is this terrifying... When I've... like worked with people with it or seen it from outside of it, there is this there's this huge fear of letting go of that identity, even when it's hurting them, even when it's damaging their relationships, even when it's like breaking down everything in their life. They are so attached to the identity and needing that identity and needing whatever that identity means to them and having to be a big deal and all that stuff, that it's like the last thing they're able to let go. They really have to hit rock bottom to let it go, which he kind of does in this movie. But it is a good example of, because then I imagine a lot of people watching this movie would be like, why can't he just let it go? Because it's like getting really bad. Why does he keep going? It's getting so bad. It's getting worse and worse. But that is probably one of the most realistic portrayals of it, is that he keeps hanging on to this behavior and this mindset, like, until the bitter end. And then he lashes out at these children angrily for forcing him to lose that identity, which is also pretty typical of someone dealing with narcissistic personality disorder, is when that personality gets challenged, you know, to lash out in anger.
So what about Tom? We get introduced to Tom Riddle, Voldemort.
I mean, we could do a whole podcast about what that fucker's deal is. Like, the... I feel like I don't even know how to start this without going off for the next half hour. Like,
yeah,
I mean, because we don't know if we're going to talk about these movies in a vacuum.
Right.
These first four. We don't know a lot yet about his parents and all that backstory, because that's like book 5 or 6 or movie 5 or 6.
That's not until 6.
Yeah, it's about the, like, his parents.
It's about how Dumbledore meets dynamic, him. Right?
Where he comes from, how he's treated. So, I mean, that's something we could probably talk about for a half hour in itself when we get to that movie. But, I mean, he's definitely a clear example of someone who also has narcissistic issues. I don't even know if I would... I mean, it is entitlement and narcissism, but I don't know. It's also antisocial.
Yeah, I would say he's more antisocial because he shows, like, more disdain for others.
Lack of empathy, for sure.
Lack of empathy, and he shows, like, an elitism, but it's not... for the sake of being elite, it's for the sake of being better than you.
Yeah.
And, like, furthering his own needs.
And it's a totally unearned elitism as well.
Correct.
I mean, I guess he was, like, a powerful wizard, but...
And he's really manipulative, like, even, like, with... Well, I guess that's way later in the movies, but... he just shows all of those characteristics so much.
Well, even in this movie, he manipulates Jenny. He manipulates Harry via the diary. Like, it's all endgame. Like, he switches on a dime how he betrays himself in that movie.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he's just out for him, 100% for sure.
And he's the one that's behind Hagrid getting expelled, even though it had nothing to do with Hagrid. It was him.
Well, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the criteria for antisocial is, like, treating people like a means to an end.
Absolutely.
And so he is the example. Like, he doesn't see people.
Right.
He sees...
No.
Circumstances. He sees pawns. He sees ways to... methods. Like, he doesn't see humans that have lives and feelings and consequences to his decisions.
No, not at all. And, like, he opens the Chamber of Secrets, and people getting killed was his fault. Because he's a parcel mouth, so he can...
Yeah, talk to snakes.
Talk to snakes, which means he can open the chamber, and then he gets kids killed, and they blame Hagrid.
Well, and also, I mean, and he is the big proponent of all the mudblood,
pure
racist
blood
bullshit, you know? And if, I mean, this is getting ahead a little bit, but he is half... human. I mean, half muggle, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is also a classic example of... I mean, people always bring this up, that Hitler's grandma was Jewish, but it's a classic, like, self-hatred as well that really pumps up, or trying to create your own identity by doubling down hard
and
against something about yourself.
Yeah.
And, like, to kind of get rid of it and to, you know... Well, I mean, it's the Kylo Ren syndrome, which is you got to burn it down to build it up.
Yeah.
Right. So... moving on from that one, what about The Prisoner of Azkaban?
So movie 3, year 3.
Year 3. That's my personal favorite of the books and of the movies. It was so well done. Like, this one was almost page for page how I imagined the movie going, or in my head when I was reading the book. Like, I thought this one was the best done. Movie 1 was also quite close.
Well, I would say this is the first movie that feels more grown up, like, where you can feel it maturing. It's darker, the themes are darker.
It's dealing
a lot more with it. Interests a lot of the things that I think continue on with the rest of the movies, which is attachment, trying to find a family, and then forming attachments with adults, and then either being betrayed by those attachments or losing them. in some way. Like, because it's the introduction of Sirius Black.
Right.
Which is his godfather. And the closest thing he feels like he is a father figure in terms of. Like, he gets really attached to Sirius Black very quickly, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. And also gets attached to Dumbledore as well. And what me and Brittany were talking about last night was that in that way, he gets attached to two men who are somewhat vulnerable, but also guarded.
Mm-hmm.
And how hard that would be for somebody who already struggles with attachment issues like Harry does, not really being able to have a secure attachment to his family because he was removed from them when they died when he was one. And so kind of seeing that he reaches out to these people who aren't really available.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's more, especially more in like movie 4, where Sirius is still in his life, but he can only communicate him via fireplace ashes. Yeah. And
that was a little weird.
Dumbledore is keeping a lot of secrets from him, but is also offers himself up as a very emotionally vulnerable space for Harry.
Mm-hmm.
It is that thing where Harry is developing a pattern of being attracted to adult role models who are only so available. Which might be his sweet spot, because a lot of kids, when they have attachment issues, tend to glom onto people who are only so available. Because there's a degree of protection there by circumstances. Mm-hmm. Like, you can only get so close because. I mean, and I think a big thing of what I noticed in this movie, the third movie, is he's a lot angrier. Like, the beginning scenes with the Dursleys, he's a lot angrier. And I don't know, and you can maybe speak to this more, Benjamin, if he is 13, he's got more testosterone pumping through him. So I don't know if part of it is just going through puberty and just feeling angrier.
Well, at 13, there's a couple things going on, particularly like as having been a 13-year-old and having a rather difficult 13th year for me. But the thing about being 13 is that you are getting more adult-sized. Like, unfortunately for poor Daniel Radcliffe, his adult size is quite small. But when I was 13, I was probably 6 feet.
Okay, so you're, like, towering over all other kids?
It's like, 6 feet, 160 probably, so I had, like, gotten quite man-sized at that point. But you develop, your testosterone is getting out of control, but you're also starting to look people who you thought of as adults as powerful figures in their eyeballs, as opposed to looking at their rib cage, you know, where you're like, hold on though, like, I'm like big shit now, you know, and you're also having a hard time. Like, there's testosterone, your muscles are growing, you're getting bigger, you're becoming thought of more of as a man. In some cultures, you are a man at that point, and you're starting to develop the ability to do something about people doing things to you.
Yeah, and so I think right off the bat, which is what I like, where I put some of that thought that I was having, is because right off the bat, he is so much angrier with the Dursleys. Like, he has that freak out towards the aunt that's visiting.
Right.
He freaks out on her. He runs away. He's having a lot more moments where you can see that he is struggling to rein it in. Like, he's sitting in his room with, like, his hands clenched, and he's so angry.
Right.
And we never saw that before within him. Like, he maybe would throw, like, a little kid fit, but, like, this was, like, this really contained fury inside of him. To the point that he does fuck out. Like, he, like, fucks off and runs away and endangers. I mean, he's only 13 still. He probably doesn't have any money. I mean, he might have magic money, but ain't gonna work in the real world, like the muggle world.
Right.
And so he doesn't really have resources still, because the Dursleys, I'm sure, aren't giving him any. And he's just so much more impulsive, and I think that's a big thing I noticed in this movie as well, is he's so much more impulsive and reckless, but in a way also that 13-year-olds are. And I think what I love about these movies, especially 3 and 4, is that he acts in the totally enraging way that a 13 and 14-year-old acts, which is, why aren't you thinking before you do anything? What annoys me when I watch other movies with child characters is that they will act like grown-ups when they shouldn't act like grown-ups. Yeah. Or they do things that grown-up, they like think things through in the way the grown-ups would. And it's like, no, you'd probably do more like this. Like, even Hermione, the smartest one, she does things out of impulse. Like, she gets all hung up on how her hair looks from behind when they're time traveling.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? But that is very... She punches Draco in the face, which could get her a lot of trouble, especially since he's a snitch and an asshole.
Yeah.
And his dad throws his dick around a lot.
Yep.
Like, he could have easily, like, called his dad, and his dad tried to pressure them to expel Hermione.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
Which he threatens to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so... They all act in a way that I think a lot of kids act when they're going through puberty, which is kind of insane. Like, they act kind of insane.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And everyone's moodier and more dramatic, and everything means so much when it shouldn't mean anything. And I appreciate that it's giving that, it's letting these kid characters have these reactions.
Yeah, I feel like they did that very authentically. And even though, like, sometimes the acting... Like, it gets better by this one, because the kids are able to, like, better understand, you know, like, yeah. what's going on. Because before, we're talking about, like, 11, 12-year-old kids, like, their yeah. acting prowess and understanding what they're doing is only
like their motivations so far. And stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
But in this one, I feel like the directing and, like, the darker filter they used on the cameras, like, everything had, like, a grittier, mm-hmm. darker feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
And they also, like... They moved Hagrid's hut, like, outside of the castle. Like, to me, that, like, kind of visually represented, more, like, more being, like, an outsider. And it being also a bigger part of the world. Because, I think, before, Hagrid's his hut was, like, looked like it was still, like, in the courtyard of the castle. So everything was all contained within Hogwarts. And this one is the first one where they're, like, opening the camera up to where you see Hagrid's hut as part of this bigger world. And when they're bringing the Hippogriff in, and mm-hmm. the Executioner from and the Minister of Magic, like, introducing all of this real adult consequence,
everything
real
is
big world stuff
to
the
pump
world.
Up.
Yeah.
Right, and then the Dementors coming in, like
Scurry stuff. And where's I going with this? And he at one point in the movie, with the impulsive stuff too, and all the stakes being higher, I mean, he strikes Snape, a teacher, with a wand. Like, he does a spell on Snape, and I know that he thinks that it's out of, like, defense for other people, but it's really because he wants to have answers. Like, it's not because
yeah.
anyone's in peril, it's because he wants something. And so he
right.
hits a teacher.
Yeah.
And that could, he could lose all of his school from that, which is his home now and his safe place.
His everything.
And he doesn't think through
yeah,
when he does that in that moment.
I was also wondering, while you guys were talking, is... Also, maybe because he knows, because now that he has this world that accepts him and that thinks that he's special and he has friends, that he also would be losing a lot more if the Dursleys fuck with him too hard. Like,
yeah.
if they really stop him from going to Hogwarts, he would be devastated.
Mm-hmm.
And how now he has something to fight for. So
yeah.
I wonder if on top of all the things that you guys pointed out, which is absolutely
yeah.
true, that there's also this sense of, I can't lose that.
Yeah,
I can't lose the ability to go to Hogwarts and to be in this magical place.
Which it makes it even crazier that he hits Snape
yeah.
in that moment.
Well, that's the whole theme. That's like where the movie starts, though.
Yeah.
It's like he gets threatened with that by the Dursley, which is why he leaves, is that because Aunt whatever her name was.
Petunia.
No,
oh,
no.
The mean lady.
The other one. Like he
the headmaster from Matilda.
Yeah.
He inflates her with the magic, and so he gets in trouble for using magic outside of Hogwarts,
mm-hmm.
which is an expulsion offense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, the, you know, he thinks that, you know, like, maybe
he gets away with a lot of wild shit.
Yeah.
He really does.
He thinks he's going to get kicked out.
Well, I think that's probably because, and this is just me speculating about the movie, is that Dumbledore probably knows we got to keep this kid, like, in our care because Voldemort's going to come after him. And also maybe recognizing, too, that Harry could be powerful, and if Voldemort gets him and, like, dark sides him.
Yeah.
We're all fucked.
Yeah.
And so I think part of why Dumbledore kind of lets a lot of things slide, one, because a lot of it happens that isn't Harry's fault. Like,
right.
even the stuff in the house with striking Snape, like, that's some crazy shit.
Yeah.
And he's 13.
Yeah.
But also, I think Dumbledore's probably like, we need him under our roof. And we need him on our side.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
And we need to keep him up on the up and up, up over here, where we can see him and watch him and keep him cool.
I mean, I've even brought up that I wonder if that's part of why... Because they let so many other things slide for Harry that are just seemingly little. But they won't let him go to Hogsmeade without this signed permission slip. Like,
right.
there's no way to get around that.
Right.
And I was saying to Brittany, I was like, I wonder if that's because they wanted to keep him on the grounds. Like,
that's
they wanted
possible.
To keep him at Hogwarts because they wanted to have a reason to
yeah.
make sure that he was safe.
And I also wonder, too, with why he runs away and is so reactive to the Dursleys, is now he's spending so much more time with the Weasleys, and maybe he's actually getting a feel for what a real family feels like and what a loving family feels like, and the Dursleys are becoming wildly unacceptable. Because I think maybe a lot of why he put up with them so much, especially if he was as isolated as we think he might have been, yeah. not going to friends' houses and stuff right. as a kid, is he might not have had any examples of what a family could feel like. And so the Dursleys, though they suck, maybe this is how it is. And now he's been in this family where Mrs. Weasley, both of them are a godsend, both parents, but Mrs. Weasley, like, she, in the first movie, she makes him that sweater that matches Ron's sweater.
Right.
Like, she really takes him under her wing and takes care of him.
That's his first present ever, yeah. isn't it?
Arguably, yeah. And
like, he gets, like, the broom and that yeah. sweater, like, at the same time. That's his first present.
Yeah. And so, but, and also, it's a situation where he doesn't earn the Weasley's love in any regard. And so she just gives him love because he's a child and he's a good kid, and she's just like, come here, and takes care of him. And so I wonder, too, if now that he's experienced that, one, he knows that he maybe could depend on the Weasleys to take care of him in a pinch. And two, that now that he knows what that's like, the Dursleys are really pieces of shit in his eyes now.
Yeah.
Like, you guys are monsters. Now yeah. that I know what you could be like,
mm-hmm.
how fucking dare you for being the way that you
are.
And
you related to me,
mm-hmm.
and you can't. Yeah. be kind to me at all.
And I think that also is something when a lot of people, when you work with them in therapy and they're changing their minds about stuff, usually the first kind of wave of changing your mind with something is getting really angry at mm-hmm. the things that you're noticing now that are true,
mm-hmm.
and how it can be really hard to rein that in. Like, a lot of times when I work with people who are changing their ideas about their families and stuff, they commonly will go through a period of time where maybe they can't be around their family because they can't rein in their anger. Because yeah. it's, they're, like, realizing all this stuff, and they're, like, it's kind of washing over them, and their anger can't really be contained. And so they create a lot of boundaries until they kind of work through more stuff, and then they feel better, and they can kind of be around the family more and more without, like, wigging out. And so it does make sense in that regard that maybe that's why he's also so much angrier with the Dursleys.
I think
so. He's because he's having a lot of revelations and epiphanies yeah. about what attachments feel like, and what caring about someone really looks like, and what love looks like, and how dare these people treat him the way they did.
Right. And then we see on the flip side of that, we also, this is the first introduction to true betrayal.
Mm-hmm.
With the introduction, because we learned that Sirius and Ramus and
Peter Pettigrew?
Pettigrew were the best friends of Harry's dad.
Mm-hmm.
We learned, like, this was his core friends. These are the people that would have, like, in our culture, Britain's is a little different, but, like, in our culture, like, they would have stood up at his wedding. This would have been, like, Sirius mm-hmm. would have been, like, his best man. And,
yeah.
like, we learned that it was Pettigrew that betrayed his family's location.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, this is the first time that real-world consequences work their way into the world of Harry Potter, where, like, the betrayal and being stuck and trapped and not able to do anything about it, and knowing the truth and still having no one believe you,
yeah,
works its way into this story, which starts to complicate it with adult themes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they that
when I think
that
it's
realization
also, yeah.
for Harry, like, really starts driving his some of the paranoia he shows.
Well, I mean, he continues to be shown in every movie, and it continues to escalate that adults cannot be trusted. Adults will not take care of you.
Yep.
And you can't trust adults to handle the situation.
No. You can't.
Which is probably why he takes so many, because I was thinking on this, like, in so many situations in books 3 and 4, any other kid would be like, oh shit, we need to tell a parent or an adult and then they'll take care of it.
Yeah.
And Harry's first instinct is, I'm gonna fucking do this myself. Like, there's several times when he'll, like, stand up to do something and Hermione will tug him down, you know what I mean? Or, like, restrain him. And because he's ready to jump in and handle it himself, which is every other kind of kid, especially at 13, would be like, well, where's the nearest adult?
I need an adult.
To handle this for me.
And I need an adult.
Yeah.
His instinct is not to go to an adult, which says a lot
yeah.
about his attachment
mm-hmm.
and his trust in adults. Like, a ton.
Absolutely. And something else that this movie does is it introduces you to depression, too. Like, the Dementors. Like, apparently, the author really based the Dementor characters on, like, her own experiences with depression. But you can tell, like, she clearly understood it. Because watching those things and, like, their description of what they do is such a insightful, to use the word of the day,
mm-hmm.
depiction of what depression is like and how I feel like it sucks the very happiness away from you so you can't feel it regardless of what you do. And I thought that that was a wonderful addition to this film. Like, the worst punishment they come up with is sending you away to a prison where they suck happiness out of your life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But also, I think Remus is a really good example of, I think, depression and guilt-based depression. Because I even wrote this down, like, as a werewolf. What would be the impact on you psychologically about, where would you put the guilt of what the things that you do when you're in wolf form? And I think I remember you thinking this a lot too in the book, like that he's a really good example of someone who struggles with regulation, like regulating your mood and then feeling guilt for the things that you do when you're not in control of yourself.
Yeah.
Because he really hates himself. More so in the books, you get that vibe.
Yeah.
That he really hates himself.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Because of being a werewolf and the things that he's done. And I think that's such a powerful example for people reading the books who may have struggled for similar things. Like, when I'm in my depression or in my bipolar, I do things I don't mean. I lash out. I'm angry, you know, and then I feel so shitty about it later, which feeds into my feelings of I'm a bad person. And then it becomes this vicious cycle of worthlessness and depression and anger and sadness and, you know, on and on and on.
Yeah, and you see some of, like, that same type of sense. Like, there's so many parallels and, like, reverses in this movie. Like, Hermione's almost, like, the opposite of that, where, like, in order to feel validated, like, she has to take so many classes that it's not physically possible.
Yeah, I don't think that was responsible of those adults to give her that thing so that she could take multiple classes.
Oh, time-turner? No.
Yeah, if they were really, like, emotionally intelligent teacher, the response shouldn't have been, oh yeah, I'm gonna help you with this problem. It should have been like, hey girl, why do you feel like you need to take twice as many classes as your peers? What's that energy about,
what
girlfriend?
About this? What about this feels like you have to take all these classes right now?
Yeah.
What is making you feel, what is making this feel urgent?
They don't show it as much in the movie, but in the book, she like is really moody and burnt out and like run ragged by doing this before even all this drama happens. Just like throughout the book, she's kind of non-existent almost because she is fatigued and like not hanging out, not acting like a kid. Like, she's kind of a mess in this book.
Yeah, she doesn't.
In the book, not so much the movie, but in the book, she's definitely like fatigued.
Right. Yeah. And like, she doesn't have as much screen time in this one either.
Yeah. Because she's not around. And they don't really, I can't remember. I read the books when I was like 14. I mean, these early ones.
Right.
But they never really get into the meat of that. Like, why she felt the need, they might have in the book, but why she felt the need to like push herself so hard. And we kind of talked about a little bit, like, I don't know if it's because she is muggle born and maybe she feels the need to prove herself, or because she just literally loves school and it's a way to make her feel good because she's kind of socially awkward. And they don't really do this in the movies, but not very attractive. In the book, they make a lot about talking about how she's not very attractive.
Like, she's very plain and very,
got big ass teeth.
Right.
And crazy ass
hair. And her hair is wild. And, and also,
and she's not very well liked.
Right. And well, because she's kind of a know-it-all.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that I noticed is it seems like it's just easier for her to connect with books than it is with people for her. And that's something that she really succeeds at. And so because of that, she doesn't have an interest in doing anything else.
And it might be because she's also turning 13 and having a lot of feelings and maybe feeling attracted to the gender she's attracted to and probably getting her period and all that stuff, that maybe that's why she doubles down on the book learning, is because she's having a lot of feelings and doesn't know where to put them and doesn't want to deal with them.
Yeah, I think that's probably dead on. And like, the last point I want to make about this movie before we talk about 4, so, you know, we could really probably have done a podcast on each of those, and maybe if this goes well and you guys want more, that could be something if we get a bunch of requests for and we might revisit. But with this movie, the concept of the Patronus, I think, is such an important thing that, from a psych standpoint, we have to talk about. And
mine's a hummingbird.
What's your guys's? Rabbit.
A big, fluffy, hairy dog. That is mine.
Of course it is.
A Newfoundland. A big
dog. Like a real Hufflepuff.
Whatever, Brittany, okay? The only reason you know it's so Hufflepuff is because you're so Ravenclaw, you probably sat and read about it.
Oh, I can see. Listen, I can look at a person from a mile away and tell you what their house is, all right? I almost never
You
wrong.
Wouldn't have guessed that I was Slytherin.
I mean, now that I know, it makes sense.
Oh, my God. Okay.
So you're going to reject that, but I had the same response.
Yeah, well.
Because you do whatever the fuck you want.
Fine.
It's been hard times here over the podcast for Hannah since she found out that she's Slytherin.
Yeah.
But anyway, the Patronus, because that's a whole other thing we can get into for a long time.
Yeah.
We could talk about the personality types and, like, who's what? What four letters make up who you are?
Right, we'll not do that right now.
But the Patronus, I thought was so powerful because it kind of illustrated to people, and probably how she figured out how she got out of her own depression. J.K. Rowling, what I mean by that is she, because there's two, it's either she or Hermione's, but I mean her. She got out of her depression by creating this world, creating Harry Potter, finding the thing that means the most to her, that gave her joy, that she dug deep for and committed to, and the only way to beat the Dementors is to dig deep within yourself and find the thing that makes you happy and feel whole, and to use that to project into this weapon against these things. I thought that was an awesome message.
I mean, it'd be a cool thing to do in treatment, which we could talk about more later, of using that as a metaphor when doing treatment with people.
Fun fact, in EMDR, you certainly do that right at the start.
Mm-hmm. I think the last thing that I notice in movie three that I think is significant is how quickly Harry puts all his hopes and dreams onto Sirius. And, like, I'm going to live with Sirius, so, and he's going to take care of me, and we're going to be like a family now. Like, all he knows about this dude is that he was a prisoner in Azkaban for a bajillion years, and that he knew his parents growing up. Like, Sirius is so angry in front of him and so impulsive and so not safe acting.
Yeah.
That,
I mean, he is
like,
scary.
It's almost like I would argue.
Oh, yeah. He's wild. Yeah.
I would argue that Harry isn't responding to Sirius. He's responding to the idea of Sirius.
Yes.
And the fact that Sirius is the closest he'll ever get to his dad. Because he was best friends with his dad.
Right. And closest he'll ever get to somebody who is magical that he can be connected to.
Yeah. Because and that's not an atypical, like, kids I've worked with who are adopted or fostered or whatever, or don't live with their birth parents.
Mm-hmm.
There can be a lot of magical thinking about the parent that you're not around or about your other options, and thinking that if I'm with that person, everything will be okay because you don't know anything about them. And so it's easy to glom on to them a fantasy about how things would be, which I think is exactly what Harry does. Think about it. Sirius is a fugitive. He probably has no money. He can't take care of you. He is dirty and crazy a little bit and a little nutty just from being in prison. And Harry acts like if they go live together, it's going to be like Leave It to Beaver or something.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't make any sense what Harry's saying when you really think about it.
Well, and also, no. I think finding any way that he can get away from the Dursleys.
100%.
Oh, well. Absolutely.
Which... No matter, even if his only option is an ex criminal.
Although he was falsely accused.
He was.
But he's now.
But.
Become.
Yeah.
Like, marked.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that can lead to such a big problem with identity, and it's fortunately Sirius goes like, hey man, that's not really realistic mm-hmm. right now.
Yeah.
Let's be real here, because just because you see the truth and other people see the truth doesn't mean the world's going to believe a 13-year-old wizard.
Yeah.
And I think he says something pretty similar to that.
He does.
And also, I mean, and what we learn if we're going to slide into movie four, God, I'm going to keep saying that. Movie four is that he doesn't get to live with Sirius, which you think would have a lot more emotional impact on him. Because what I notice is movie four does not start with what it usually starts with, which is
him
the summer
at the
Dursleys. We don't see that at all.
No.
Because I would anticipate he would be a mess at the Dursleys, because he probably gave his hopes up about living with Sirius. He's not living with Sirius because Sirius is on the run or whatever. He's in hiding. And so now he has to go back to the Dursleys. Especially after, like, I just feel like there's no way he's not, like, an out-of-control mess at the Dursleys in terms of anger. And so it is interesting that we don't see that at all. And I don't know if that was just a directing choice because they wanted to start the movie differently than they have in the other three. You know, to make sure it's not super formulaic.
Mm-hmm.
But I think from a therapist standpoint, it would be really interesting to see how he was presenting at the Dursleys that summer after being given this glimmer of hope about a different life, and especially after running away from them in a fit of anger the summer before.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And he's only getting older and bigger and more full of testosterone.
Yeah.
Right. So we see, like, with this movie, this starts almost immediately with the arrival of the other schools, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yes.
Because I think the first thing
we see... Like the opening ceremony at the for their first meal together.
And we see the big ship and the flying carriage come in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like what makes this movie interesting to do is there's so much development and growth in the kids where we see like, oh, now it's like high school.
I love it so hard. I think when I was watching the movie with Hannah last night, I was like, I fucking love that these kids are all such goddamn messes. Because right? it's so 14. The whole fit that Hermione throws at the end at Ron, which is really crazy. Like when she's just like, you don't get anything. I'm just trying to have a good dance. And you're such a prick. And like he doesn't really do anything that makes why she's like she, her fit is like over the top. And all I could think was, is this girl started her period? And this also my other thought was, this is why when you're 14, you need to have
girlfriends
when you're a girl. Because you're starting your period, you're liking, well, possibly liking boys, depending on your orientation. But I'm trying to, I don't want to be gender exclusive. But
well, feeling you, attracted to other people, regardless of the gender. And just
trying to figure out your body, you're getting boobs, like,
yeah.
You know. And especially with her, in the book version of her, her whole appearance changes. They don't really do that in the movie, which is disappointing.
Yeah.
But, so there's also this, like, she's getting attention from boys in a way that she wasn't before, and just hormonal, and just, I can't imagine, I mean, I had a lot of brothers, and so because of that, I had a lot of female friends, because I had enough of that sausage at home.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine going through all the changes at 14 and only having dudes around me. It'd make me insane. I would be like her. I would probably have these freak outs where I screamed at them for no reason.
Yeah.
And just shoved them and been like, get the fuck out of my face. Like, I would just freak out on them all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, like, she...
And they are being assholes.
They are. And she did another thing that's actually, like, I mean, like, typical to see sometimes with girls that are more advanced than boys their ages, she seeks out someone older and more mature, even though he's a meathead. Like,
but I think he's... I wish... I don't know. I was debating if I thought maybe she should have ended up with, like, a Victor Crumb type instead of Ron. But that's a real...
Yeah, we can't go down. We can't go down that.
We
can't go down that.
We can talk about that in the later movies. But I think you're exactly right, Ben, is that also she's more mature than them. She's probably she's always been intellectually more mature than them, but now she's probably also emotionally more mature than them.
Well, I think it's also fairly common for girls to be a little bit more emotionally mature at this age.
Oh, yeah.
In some ways, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Just in general. So, like, even the this portrayal, I don't think, is that off in that you would she is a little bit more mature than them.
And Ron acts surly as fuck, and that's very age appropriate.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and she wants nothing to do with it, and is like, he is also, like, nervous, and him and Harry, like, asking out girls is so accurate, like, trying to figure out, like, how do I figure that out? Like, none of you were 14-year-old boys having to do that for the first time, like, and realizing how fucking terrifying girls are for the first time in your life, like, because middle school girls are the meanest thing on the planet, fight me.
I wouldn't
meanest
know.
Meanest thing on the planet, except no for maybe house cats. But girls, you're mean. Girls are mean. They're mean to each other. They exclude. I just taught a bullying class. They are mean. They exclude each other. And angry, fine. But you're like trying to find your place in the world and fighting each other and trying to find ways to justify your fit with other girls. Boys are doing the same thing, but girls do it in different ways where boys will punch each other in the face.
Yeah, I definitely had.
It's more drama.
The more, like, more drama with other females who were older than me.
Yeah.
But I was bossy and was like, I, like, scared a couple dudes and stuff. Because, like, I was intense. So, I was asking out boys. And so, they weren't usually the other way around. So, and it was kind of a lot. But I definitely agree with that there is a lot of... There's so much intensity behind all of your emotions at age.
And everything seems like the biggest thing that's ever happened.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
And but I think what I like... And I know I'm kind of repeating myself why I'm so much like that in this movie and why it's something to keep in mind when you are an adult dealing with teenagers. And what I try to keep in mind when I have kid, preteen, teen clients is that those things are a big deal. And just because you as an adult know that that's not a big deal in the long run doesn't mean that you should invalidate it or dismiss it. because that, I mean, like social stuff and like drama within your friends and relationship stuff and breaking up and someone did this, and God forbid nowadays with Instagram, like you didn't like my picture and all that bullshit. But that is like also how we learn how to handle conflict and to how to have issues with people that we love and to work through them is by, these are all kind of like training runs for the big stuff when you become a grown up. And so it's good to treat it with the respect that these kids feel it, because everything's relative. And in the little microcosm that is your 14-year-old world, everything is like the biggest thing that ever happened to you. And also, everything's happening to you for the first time.
And right. How in some ways learning how to deal with those things at those ages is so much safer in some ways, because there are so many other things outside of that that are already controlled versus a 14-year-old kind of like a skirmish with girls is not that big of a deal. But if you don't learn that until you're 22, it's your first job and you get fired, that's a lot bigger consequence than learning these things at the ages that are really when it's the safest.
Yeah. And you see like another like concept that starts to show itself is the difference between like the micro bullying that you see between like the individual level of like Harry and Draco fighting each other and dealing with bullying that way, to where you see it like when Harry's name gets pulled for the goblet.
Oh, kids are pissed at him.
And everyone is so angry at him, like to the point where like
those buttons,
they create buttons and like magic things, and like even people that Harry thinks are his friends are wearing them and like making fun of him and thinking that like Cedric is awesome and like fuck Harry, basically. Like Harry is a liar, he's a cheater. And
how quick they turn on him
is so hard.
So hard, it's because so it's 14. Like, fuck, like he already has so much proof that he has so many different ways to have negative core beliefs about himself, to have all of this reinforcement that he is evil or a cheater or rotten in some way. It's just so awful.
Yeah, and but I think it is that thing where, where because he is already so famous in a lot of respects, and everyone knows he probably has money, like that's... Like, he's fucking fine. Like, you know, they're probably like, this fucking prick. Like, he already is, like, the most famous kid and, like, the richest kid in the school. And now he has to do this, which is breaking all the rules because he doesn't have enough attention. Like, I could see why. Because of that age, too, you're not very nuanced yet with things. Right. Everything's still very black and white. Like, you don't really understand the depths of people and their motivation. So, at that age, in high school, it's very easy to be. I mean, like, think about how much someone's, like, the bad boy or the slut. And, like, everyone is, like, labeled. And there's not a lot of empathy or sympathy within that, because you're thinking so concretely still about who someone is.
Right. Absolutely. And what's sad about this one is that we see Ron turn on Harry.
Yeah, but I get it. I get it. Here's the thing. Here's my little spiel. And I get it if you guys don't. You know, agree with me. But I think that Ron comes from this big family. And Ron's also, like, the second youngest. But he's also the youngest boy. And so there's nothing really, quote-unquote, special about him within the family. Because Ginny's younger than him, but she's the first girl. So I'm sure she got a lot of, like, almost, like, first child energy towards her. And so he's already in a family where everyone's kind of all over each other, walking all over each other, talking all over each other. He gets hand-me-down clothing. He's poor. You know, there's a big part, and there's a little scene in the beginning of the movie where he's trying to buy candy off the trolley.
Right.
And he goes, oh, I only have, well, never mind. I only will take one thing. And then Harry jumps in and is like, I can buy it for you. And he's like, no. And so I think there's probably a lot more awareness within him about how poor he really is. And like, at that age, you're trying to figure out who you are. And already feeling kind of like you're only one of many in your family. And then your best friend being like the chosen one. And so continuing to just kind of be like next to the person that's important or the person that's getting all the attention. It's never you. And so, and then the wizard cup thing happens. And, you know, and I could just see where at that age when you're already surly and trying to figure out who you are. And you probably have all this stuff from your childhood kind of coming up to the brim. You know, and feeling more of the social impact of being poor and having hand-me-down clothes and being made fun of that because you're trying to be attractive to the gender you're attracted to and you're trying to, like, learn where you are in the high school hierarchy. I could see where it all kind of boils together like a perfect storm and just gets projected onto Harry. Because also Harry is a safe person for him to be shitty towards because they love each other. And also they only squabble for the first, like, third of the movie before they're fine again. And he's still protecting him. Like, after the first trial, he's like, I told you about the dragons, and we're cool now, right? So it's not like that covers the whole you know, movie. It's just the very beginning. But I think it's a very age-appropriate, understandable reaction.
Oh, yeah, I think it's age-appropriate for sure, but I can see also why Harry would yet again feel abandoned and, like, you know, I don't, we've covered kind of his
It's trust. All about Harry. See, we're You're only thinking about Harry. We're not thinking about Ron.
I get it.
Why who's not thinking? No one's thinking about Ron. Everyone's just thinking about everything impacts Harry. But I don't think that Ron, I think it's just a product of being immature, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't think he was right in his choices, and I think he did Harry a bit dirty. But I don't think he had the emotional intelligence to get that. I think he was just, I mean, when you're that age, it's just everything that you feel is, like, everything that's happening to you is, like, the worst. And so you can't see outside of that sometimes.
No, you can't. And then, like, we learn yet again that the defense against the dark arts teacher, which I have to admit, like, my disagreement with the writing in these stories is, like, every time it's like, I wonder who the defense against the dark arts teacher is. Like,
yeah.
I was listening to some people talk about it, and even they're like, look, I have an argument with this, is that, like, Harry Potter basically operates, especially for the first more movies, like an episode of Scooby-Doo. Like, every time I'm like, oh, we're going to pull off the mask.
These meddling kids.
These meddling kids. Like, yeah. And then, like, even, like, Mad-Eye Moody, who seems to, like, show some more investment into Harry until, like, the end, where you start to realize that he's
horrible.
Is a villain. Like, Harry, like, can't trust adults
yet
again. And, like, all other adults are Death Eaters, and we get our first introduction into, like, the actual evil of Death Eaters, where the imagery they chose to use of them I thought was interesting, because they chose KKK.
Yeah, it looks like. I said that, because it looks like the robes and all that stuff.
Right, with the robes, and, like, you, like, come across, like, the first real terror, which I would point out that I thought was irresponsible of Arthur.
Ron's dad?
Yeah, to surprise Harry with, like, some kind of magic thing. Like, oh, we're just going on a trip. Like, just do this thing. Like, that's probably traumatic for Harry there, Arthur. Like, you probably shouldn't do that to Harry. Like, I get why he's, like, being, like, the surprising father. Like, I'm taking my kids to something awesome, and Harry's coming too. And, like, I'm not going to tell him. We're just going to go to the World Cup. It's going to be awesome.
No, but I think that is, he's just operating as someone who's always lived in the magical world. And so, he asks Harry very rudimental questions about what the Muggle world is like. So he just kind of operates within, like, this is a magical world, and, like, Harry should know what's, you know what I mean? Like, he doesn't thinking about how alien it is to Harry. And if he is, he's a pretty whimsical dude, Arthur, so I think he's probably thinking. And I guess I would argue, I keep defending Ron, is that because he's from a big family and with his parents who are so, like, loving and supportive like they are, I bet it doesn't occur to Ron that if he ostracized Harry, that means so much to Harry. Because Ron probably got Ron's probably gotten a lot of fights with his loved ones where they fight, siblings. Where they don't talk to each other, but they feel secure because they have other people backing them up. Like, it isn't this thing where every relationship is, like, the capital relationship in your life.
Right.
And so because he has his parents, like, and all the family and stuff, and has had a lot of conflict with a lot of siblings, it probably doesn't mean as much to, like, write somebody off for a little bit.
Probably not. And then, like, to Ron, like, I mean, they're sure they see that in their family, but to Harry, that's everything.
Mm-hmm. But at your age, you don't know that. Like, you can't think of it like that.
Right. I mean, you can't. And so this movie, then there's two points in this movie before we move into treatment here where we need to cover where shit gets real.
Yeah.
Because when...
Horrible.
When they put, like... I mean, we could talk about, like, the Wizard Cup competition, but that's just really just kind of fantastical fun, like, plot driving.
It is super fun. I think that's why I like the fourth book and the fourth movie so much, is it's very much like, ooh, like, we're doing a thing, and, like, it's all this magical stuff and learning. It explodes the world so much more.
Oh, yeah.
And learning about these other schools, and then just having these fun trials and, like, riddles and stuff.
Oh, yeah. And,
like, it is one of the funnest movies in that regard.
Absolutely. Yeah. Until, like, that maze where, like, ooh, they start switching and things get dark, and Crumb gets possessed, or they get bewitched, I guess would be the word that they use.
Yeah, yeah.
But they show, like, Moody shows you the curses, and then you find out what actually happened to poor Neville's parents, and, like, they traumatize Neville with that. So these things start to get real about halfway through the movie, but then you go through and you see Voldemort materialize for real.
Mm-hmm.
And Voldemort is now real, and you find out more about Harry than you knew, like, that Harry's power part comes from Voldemort. Mm-hmm. Like, that had to be a crushing blow to Harry.
Yeah.
Like,
well, I mean, at this age when everyone's developing their identity and trying to figure out who they are, and he already doesn't have a foundation of identity, it's so feeble.
Well, he started to buy into it now. Now he's got 4 years of everybody telling him he's awesome, and now he's doing well, and he's like...
And he's kicking it in the... He's, like, killing it in the Triwizard Cup.
With kids that are 3 years old and more older than him.
I mean, he's only had 3 years of school.
It's a real Mary Jane Harry Potter, you could argue.
Yeah, you could argue that. Mary Sue?
Is that what it is?
Mary Sue, like Rey. Like, people argue that Rey in Star Wars is a Mary Sue. Yeah, which it's another bullshit argument we could probably tear down. But the... that introduction, like, where Voldemort becomes real, and I thought Ralph Fiennes is fantastic as Voldemort.
Really, he's so good. We talked about it. We were talking about it last night when we were watching
He's so good. It's just all the choices he makes is so... He's really good at doing so many subtle things that are very inhuman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, not having the nose, which probably wasn't his choice. The voice, which they did in the first movie, so that was pretty consistent. I was impressed with how consistent that was.
Yeah, because that wasn't even him then, I don't think.
Yeah, no. Having, like, his fingernails and toenails be a little too long, continuing to not wear shoes, like, the way he dresses in this weird, like, androgynous robe. Yeah. Like, it's all very, like, otherworldly in a way that's very unsettling.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, like, him, like, informing Harry that, like, your special powers, like, your mother's love was what protected you, but now what makes you special is me. You know, like, he's, like, tearing Harry down and manipulating and fucking this whole world that Harry has believed, because he's defeated Voldemort 3 times now, like, sort of.
And right.
Now
we're in the real shit now.
We're in the real shit, and we're taking this down, and then Voldemort kills Cedric like it's nothing.
Yeah, I mean, they kill him pretty immediately.
Yeah. As soon as he realizes that Harry came not alone. Kid.
So then there's the guilt. Well, one, the trauma of simply witnessing a death in front of you of a peer. So that's one thing that sucks. And also someone who's very beloved and probably you looked up to and was a good... I mean, they do such a good job of this movie of continuing to reiterate that Cedric is such a good person. He never is really like... He, like, helps Harry when he can.
Yeah, they show he's the Hufflepuff
so,
of him.
Yeah, he's so sweet. He's, like, a true Hufflepuff in, like, the best context. And, like, and so to lose someone like that who is such a good, like, a golden boy, and then it feeling like it's your fault.
Right.
And so that's the second layer of it feeling like you brought this upon him and brought his death upon you, especially when you're 14 and so you think a lot more concretely like that.
Right. Yeah.
Everything's more black and white in those thought patterns.
Yeah.
And, oh, God. And then the trauma of when they come back and seeing his dad, Cedric's dad, realize that Cedric is dead.
And then that
itself would be, like, any of those things separately are traumatizing, and then they all happen together. And then, in the crucial moment when someone could have comforted him and made him feel better, he gets, again, traumatized by the fake Mad-Eye Moody.
Right.
Who...
Barty Crouch Jr.
Yeah, takes advantage of him and just reiterates an old trauma he has of adults are deceitful and I cannot trust them.
And it's Snape who saves him, isn't it? Is it Snape who busts in?
Snape always kind of saves him.
And busts in and, like...
He busts in and controls Barty first, and then Dumbledore comes in. But I think the other thing that's kind of a subtle trust issue that happens in this movie as well is that Dumbledore didn't catch it either.
Right.
So now, this person, who is supposed to be the most powerful wizard that I know, and really seems to believe in me and trust in me, he also didn't know that this was happening.
Right.
So now no one can keep me safe. I would see Harry being in a trauma state for weeks after this, all of this happens.
Oh, at minimum.
Yeah. And I mean,
his ability to trust adults just continues to be destroyed. And not, because it's like adults are not... I mean, they're like intentionally, malevolently not trustful, but then also in this very, like, incidentally kind of idiotic way, also not trustful.
Right. Yeah. So I think from here, this is a natural springboard to build into treatment, which we've kind of worked in a little bit. So we've kind of talked about a little bit, and I feel like, I mean, any trauma situation that comes up, I'm going to default to EMDR because that's what I specifically took to train. But I've also covered that in a lot of podcasts, so I'm going to kind of decline to do that in this one because I've covered that a lot of times because we've talked about a lot of trauma. But like with treatment in this, we haven't talked a lot about how I think group as a modality is helpful and important. And so I think I kind of want to highlight that in here, because I think in this situation, breaking down some of the kids into groups for some of the things that they're dealing with, because we've got a couple kids that deal with anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And we got a couple kids that deal with some depression, and we got a couple kids that deal with trauma.
Well, I would argue that Neville Longbottom and Harry are very unique in that they have almost the same situation.
Correct.
In terms of their parents and losing them and as babies. And like they would, and Neville seems, maybe because his grandma seems a lot, and maybe his disposition is a lot more gentle. Than Harry, but he's also very brave and has a good heart. And so I think that, like you're saying, would be a good opportunity to be in a room with someone who is, in a lot of ways, the same circumstances as you, to feel more connected to other people and to feel like you're not alone in your trauma.
Right,
in
right.
your experience.
And in my defense of that would be, like, I mean, this comes out later in the movies, but, like, when they start creating Dumbledore's Army and things like that, and you start to see the growth out of Neville and the growth mm-hmm. out of some of the other characters who before didn't really have a role or a place, where they yeah. start to get some belief in themselves and connect into other people and go, like, okay, so it's not just Harry that's this fantastical, magical person. It's, like, other people that can
yeah.
find meaning and purpose and development mm-hmm. in their life. And I think having a group modality to do that and explore some of that to, like, create or, like, eliminate some of this. Harry is, like, the golden child, and, like, and mm-hmm. Hermione is, like, the smartest. Like, there's other kids that are smart. Like, mm-hmm. we're hardly exposed to, especially in the movies, like, the Ravenclaws that, like, Hermione is way more similar to than the Gryffindors. Like, granted, she's very brave and true-hearted, but she's also, like, totally into her books, and that is, like, one of the clear defining characteristics mm-hmm. of the Ravenclaws, and we don't have any exposure to them hardly at all throughout the series. I mean, Cho is one, but other than that, you don't really have...
Luna yeah. is. Luna Lovegood. She's going to come up yet, but she's my fave.
Yeah, and, and we don't see that, but I think, like, creating a spot where it's not so much, like, these special kids get singled yeah. out, like, but where we have something, a trained therapist that can focus on bringing out the community, the camaraderie, and the
mm-hmm.
ability to connect all these kids, I think that would be what I would want to see happen. And I don't...
Yeah.
Especially because no. I think you see Harry really blossom in that role when he's training the kids, and
yeah.
how that really helps him build mm-hmm. a safe, stable identity for himself of how he can take what he has and also get some more support around how kind of he is really good at some things.
Yep, right.
I mean, like, the mm-hmm. fact that he could do the Patronus the way that he did in the third movie or whatever.
Yeah, the third, which is a super advanced magic.
Yeah, like, the way that he can do things, that he can share it, and that mm-hmm. it doesn't have to be something that's special to him. He doesn't have to hoard these things. And how, yeah. so yeah, I think doing group would be just really... really powerful for Harry and well, for yeah. and for all the kids struggling with different things.
Like, the only, and, like, the thing I really want to highlight is one of the things that the strengths of group, particularly with kids this age and done by a skilled professional, and I'd probably want there, like, to be groups to be run by two, like, because
yeah.
one of the things in group modality you don't see often anymore outside of hospitals that's really part of the group modality is to have a leader and a co-leader.
Mm-hmm.
And you may want to do that with people of different genders or different identity types so that you can play off each other and model roles.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people like Harry wouldn't have even gotten that. Like, you see, like, the difference, like, you'd have somebody like Sirius and then somebody like McGonagall.
Yeah.
Like, mm-hmm. like, blending, like, the two, and not because they're male and female, but because their personalities show something. Like, one's a little wild and one's, like, strict rule follower. And having that would be helpful. But also, it would help address the bullying that is clearly a problem at this school that the teachers do shit about.
Yeah.
And I have
probably
a problem
want
with that.
The groups to have blended houses.
Agreed.
You probably
yeah.
want to make sure that there's kids of every house in the group.
Yep.
And I think, because I've run a lot of groups with kids as little as five, and so there's always an argument that people like to make the argument that kids, especially young kids, can't do groups because they're not emotionally mature enough. But they are. If they can hold a conversation, they can be in a group.
Yeah,
oh,
I've
yeah.
done groups with kids. That's patently false.
Yeah, and so I think what's really powerful about groups, too, is, well, one, I think kids, too, because you're younger and everything's so much more black and white, if you feel alone, you genuinely feel like you're alone. And it's
yeah.
really hard for you, because you're still developing your empathy, to understand that other people have a similar experience to you, just because that part of your brain's not fully developed yet, to really
yeah.
be able to understand that other people have had things happen to them that's very similar to you.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can feel even more isolated because of that. And so why groups at that age are really powerful, like, that's why I brought up Neville, is hearing someone have a story that's like your story makes you feel a lot less like you're a bad kid and that's why that's happened to you. It makes it more about that the situation just fucking sucks, or the people that did that thing to you are the bad guys, not you, because you're the only person that's ever happened to you, is how it can feel. Yeah. And so when you realize it's happened to other kids and you like that kid and that kid's a nice kid, then it makes you kind of challenge how you've internalized what's happened to you.
Absolutely.
And how maybe your parents treated you, or how if someone abused you or something happened to you. And so that's really powerful. And also, especially at this age, 14, I mean, as much as I hate to admit it as an adult now, kids do not listen to you like they listen to their peers.
Yeah.
And so when their peers give them feedback, they will listen to that and take that more seriously a lot of the times than they will about an adult. Because it's very easy for them to just be like, oh, fucking grown up, they don't get it.
Oh,
or
yeah.
Or they're just telling me what to do. And they can very easily, like, write off and compartmentalize what you're saying. But I've seen groups where, like, if a kid their age can say something to them that's very powerful, it, like, will knock a kid's block off in a good way. It'll, like, blow their mind. And it'll mean something so much more to them. Because also they're at an age where just your peers and their opinions are so fucking important. That's just, why they're all having, like, so these much tantrums weight like they are.
On your identity.
Yeah.
Right. But it also gives them equal ground. And, like,
it's
the great equalizer. It's going to, like, have someone in there that will enforce, like, everybody's different and everybody's experiences are valuable, but everybody's opinion and insight is just as valuable and you're all on equal footing. And I think, like, for me, that's what I would want to see. What about you two?
I mean, I think what you said, the group's really good. I was thinking if I saw Harry after, at any point in these movies, at this age, like, at this younger age in his life, I think especially after, like, the first or second movies, if I were to see him, I'd probably be very person-centered, and what I mean by that is let him lead the sessions, because I think for a lot of his younger life, he's not been listened to and not been treated with, like, that he has a voice and an opinion that deserves respect. And so I wouldn't want to be another adult who's kind of, like, leading him around or bossing him around, you know, or feeling like I have an agenda. Like, I would probably do a lot in session of, like, leaning back and letting him talk about whatever he wants to talk about so that he feels empowered about having an opinion and about having a voice, and kind of going from there. And I would also assume that it'd probably take a while before we talked about really serious stuff.
Yeah.
But also, I will take that back, too, because sometimes when I work with kids like that, as soon as they have a space to talk about what they want to talk about, sometimes they'll just go. Like, they hit the ground running.
Absolutely.
And they're like, fucking finally, somebody, like, gives a shit. And they'll, like, just barf all their feelings onto you.
Right.
And so I think I would do a lot of letting him lead so that he felt empowered in sessions with me. And then I think a lot of this Harry Potter stuff is really, could be used really interesting in therapy. Like, the Mirror of Isered is a really good example of what we call magical thinking, or the magical questions. How I, and what I mean by that is, I usually use what we call, I call the magic wand question, which is, if you had a magic wand and you could wave it and it'd make your life whatever you wanted it to be, or like the perfect version of your life, what would it look like?
Yeah.
And so you could use the Mirror of Isered as kind of like, if you looked in that mirror, what would you see? And it can be really insightful to understanding what they really want, and also if their expectations of a perfect life are realistic. Like, if they're waiting on something or depending on something that's not going to ever really happen, or that doesn't need to happen for them to have a good life. Or it can also be insightful because maybe the perfect world is without them in it.
Right.
And that's, you know, could feel like a really scary response, but also tells you a lot about what their head's at. And I think another thing that I thought of as a therapist when I was watching it was, in the third movie, Lupin does of this the ridiculous spell with them, which is where he has them all think of, like, a, I think it's a Bogart, he has them see something that really scares them, and then he supposed to reframe it into something that makes you laugh. And I thought that was a really good way of changing your thought about something really scary, as well as thinking about something really funny, and that way you can think about it differently and it's not as scary anymore. What about you, Hannah?
So I think that I would do, you know, I think you guys have really great suggestions, and I don't know that I would do something a lot differently. And because right now there's so many different groups of them, I was trying to think of, like, who would I have in my office, like, for family therapy, and maybe it would be Dumbledore, like, having Dumbledore and Harry, and maybe Sirius, and just helping them with communication, because it's so clear that that is
a mess.
Yeah, it's so clear that that is something that they would really need help with. So I think I would just try to help Harry find safe, find safe adults that he can work with.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's something that could be done with other people or not. It might be too hard for him to process that at that time.
Well, I think it'd be really hard. I think maybe nothing else you can teach him, like, how do you know if someone's a healthy
attachment or not? Exactly.
Oh, then that's a huge thing that he needs to know.
And you can create supports that aren't your family.
Exactly.
Moving him away from trying to make something work with the Dursleys or Sirius because they're his family, quote unquote, and being like, no, you can find support with your friends and the people that you choose, and that could be more powerful.
Yeah.
It's the whole, like, you know, blood's thicker than water kind of argument.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's what I would do.
Well, final thoughts?
I mean, I love Harry Potter. Like, if I like, if I had to put it in, like, my, like, pantheon of movies, like, my top fives, like, this Harry Potter, the series, is up there. I love it. I think it's fantastic. I think it's permeated culture well and is existing well, and I look forward to reading it to my daughter when she's old enough to understand.
Adorable. Oh, it's so cute.
I mean, I love that these movies, and we'll get into this more when we do the other four, that they grow with the children. They become more mature as the kids in the story become more mature, and the movies also do that. And that they take a lot of these, the way the kids feel, seriously, which as a child therapist, I'm all about. And they don't, it's not just serious stuff they take seriously, but like the romance. And the fourth movie is all about romance and not being able to get your shit together.
Yeah. I love Harry Potter, and I watch it all the time, and I have a Deathly Hallows tattoo on my arm, so I love it, and it was a lot of fun to do this episode, and I look forward to doing the other two episodes for you guys.
All right, and so we will be on hiatus for the next month of September, just because of scheduling and things like that, but we will be back in October with Scary Movies for Halloween, so look for us then. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at Popcorn Psychology. You can find us at popcornpsychology@gmail.com. if you want to email us. And we are on Twitter, it's popcorn_psych. And so find us if you would like.